Hi, everybody. I'm Mary Pinard. I'm very, very delighted and honored to be here, and also to get to introduce my dear friend and poet sister and mentor, Maura Linehan. Just a couple of things. We met about 1,000 years ago at the MFA program at Vermont College. We then decided it would be interesting and a nice journey and a way to support our lives as poets to work together. So for over 20 years, we have been exchanging poems approximately every month-ish. I send poems to her, she sends poems to me, we have lunch at either person's house, and that's really kept us strong and connected as poets and as writers. She's extraordinarily talented. She's going to be reading from these two books. I wanted to show them to you. You can purchase them back there. If No Moon, which won the open competition for the Southern Illinois Press competition, which means that all poets from all universes enter, and this book won first prize. That's 2007. And this is her brand new book called Incarnate Grace, which was just published this year. They're both extraordinary, and she is my role model and mentor, and I'm very delighted to welcome her.
Thank you, Mary. Well, I want to begin by thanking Henry and Amanda for the welcome, for the attention that they've been giving the two of us in preparation for this reading. And I thank you for coming out on such a hot, humid night. We very much appreciate that. I want to read just one book, one poem from If No Moon. If No Moon is a story about losing my husband. He battled cancer for 4.5 years. And this poem called Back comes from late in the collection. And I offer it to you in case this is one of your subjects. If it's not climate, perhaps. If it's grief. This is about coming out of that experience, and you can, if you're interested, the book documents my journey through and out. Back. This, after all, is how I came back. Back into place in this world, all suckle and juice, plum, tomato, chilled wine, even plain water dribbling down my chin. How long was I gone in my grief? Almost too long, but back now in time. Find me, follow me, I've a tale of passage through this roadside barrier, barbed wire fence, brambles and briars, mirror of where I long was, tangled in vines, twisting and twisted around, vast trunks climbing up from the soil, down from branches, vines thick as clothesline, thin as fiber. I'm here to report no one comes back, except by desire, that sinuous pleasure snaking along each limb, leading you forward and back as you reach for ripe peach, dark grapes. The purpose of Mary and my being here tonight is to read from our new collections, and this book, if you look for it on the back table, as Mary said, you'll see it's a map, and it includes Winchester. I live in Winchester, and it shows you Winter Pond. I live on Winter Pond, and so I'm very interested in wildlife, in bird life. I can't identify many of the birds. I can't tell you things about them, but I watch their habits and their behavior, and I've been doing that for close to 35 years. So this poem opens on Winter Pond, there's an extended metaphor going on in this collection, which I'll talk about shortly. But I'll begin with naming it. This gift, like binoculars, so I can see up close with both eyes what's out there, the weight of it. I rest my elbows on my desk to get a steadier look at this moment at what is swimming toward me across the pond, lone brown duck, much smaller than a mallard. What I see that I could not see without this gift, white ring at the end of its bill. Isn't this how I always want to look? in the moment, the distant brought in close, so I can read it in detailed relief. I'm holding on with both hands so I can take in what's here now in front of me. Ring-necked duck, migrating who knows where. What I could not name save for these binoculars, this new way of looking, this breast cancer. So this book was triggered by my diagnosis of breast cancer in 2009. And this is an early poem about starting to come to grips with that diagnosis. It's titled Electric. Fine line of my breast cells flush on the brink between breast and right here, hard rope of a scar. Tumor cut from that border, host breast, chest wall. Cancer had embroidered the milk glands there. Left with a swollen right breast, I don't know, so erect, taut. Fold line, now scar line, which tugs each time I reach with that arm. Ongoing, electric, this fear as I lie in the dark. Margins clean, but not ideal. Echoes of my surgeon's voice. So that's what my surgeon had told me, that my margins were clean, which is what you want when you have a cancer removed. However, she said, not ideal. And so I focused on the word margin and tried to understand what margin meant. And so if you look in the dictionary, I was reminded of how many meanings that word has. And so I saw, as a poet, that I could use those many meanings to try to explore what this felt like. So, marginal. What book? What exhibit? I can't remember where, the year I saw those photos of women with mastectomies. A fundraiser? Maybe a survivor's celebration. Was I alone? Raw red slashes, thin puckered sashes drawn down one side of their chests. A branding, a lightning strike, what I knew I'd never forget. Maybe it was a documentary. All those faces I see now. How soon afterwards were they taken? There must have been dates. The whole world can damn well go ahead and stare. Those women of all ages, all sizes, of fierce, defiant, remaining breast. How could I ever join a support group about bras and prostheses, wigs, lumpectomy scar, knotted crescent moon, cupping one breast? So another meaning of margin. Land that's immediately adjacent to a body of water. And I was lucky to, as this place allows writers to come and have residents have time to be away and to concentrate on their work. I went to a residency on the West Coast in the San Juan Islands, and I went there empty in the sense of I had no idea what I was going to be writing about, except I wanted to write about what was happening at that margin next to that other ocean. So when I got there, there was a new law that had gone into effect. And I was seeing everywhere these signs that said, get off my tail. And it was a law that had gone into effect for boaters to stay 100 yards back from orca whales. People are quite fascinated because they're so much smaller than our whales and other whales. And so I began to think about that law in terms of breast cancer and the kind of person whom I was. So breast cancer 180. I, who'd always lived a ways away, at a distance, out of sight, touch, days, weeks alone, inside, behind, yes, without connecting. now 180, at the very least going to, toward, approaching them, all my beloved still on this earth. I want them by, around, near, close, next to, alongside, with me these days. Want the links, the bindings, the fasteners, the clips, the glue, tape, and string. But back then, in those times, earlier, back when, before, wouldn't I have loved this law regarding on behalf of orcas out among between the San Juan Islands, that law silkscreened in blues on posters, the backs of T-shirts, get off my tail, 100-yard order to boats to back off, stay back, give those beauties right of way. From the window, the front window of the cottage where I was, I could see the ferry coming from the mainland to Friday Harbor, and I began to watch that ferry and began to think about Karen, the mythical character who was responsible for ferrying people to the underworld. Ferry. The day's last ferry slipping out for the mainland, each window on its many decks lit before me, a Frank Lloyd Wright design, clean line, stained glass upon the nighttime waters. Barely moving this ferry, its reflection, and I'm held on shore at a window. In 6 days, I'll walk back into its hungry mouth. In sunlight's glare, that ferry's mouth blacker than the woods tonight behind me. Beyond the harbor, the ancient boatman's rowing, rowing since the world began, coming toward me in his open dinghy, ferryman for what will be my passing. The island's ferries passed. Or Karen's already claimed me as his passenger. So slowly do we glide, I don't even know I'm on board. Another meaning of margin, white space around text. And I decided that there was one particular text that I wanted to look at. Because of the intricacy of the design work in illuminated manuscripts, I wanted to look at the Book of Kells, a manuscript created by Irish monks around the year 800. And I decided that if you're going to be looking and thinking about illuminated manuscripts, you really need to be in Ireland in order to do that well. So I found myself a residency in Ireland, north of Dublin, and wrote a series of poems. And one of them is called The Theology of Manuscript Illumination. And please forgive me for claiming to be a theologist, but loosely, The Theology of Manuscript Illumination. Monstrous margins of wild seas surround his island. In the scriptorium, measured margins enclose the wondrous words he's arranging on paper. Margins as frontiers from whence come creatures flying or running, swimming or crawling into the lines, finding letters to curl in, gnaw on, wrestle, pin to the page. Illumination putting flesh on each word. Christ as word, once again made present by the hand of a scribe, a monk with his quill moving letter unto letter, old page of text copied onto the new, despite the room's stone chill, despite the ache along his neck's right side. Weeks before this part of the story comes unto its end. On this page, the word, again the way, offering passage across the border to the kingdom within. So there are other margin poems in the collection. I wanted to give you that overview. I have two more poems that I'd like to share with you. I'm going to bring you back to Winter Pond in Winchester, and I'm going to connect back to my first book. This one is called My Great Blue, and this little bit of birding information, I know people refer to great blue herons as a great blue. My great blue. Eventually, even my grief would leave me. Late November, the great blue's lifting off for the season, though maybe it doesn't yet know that. Surely I don't. Who doesn't know more afterwards? Those moments after the birds decided, but before it's the thinnest of barks slipping through air. Those in-between moments, wings seeming to beat air in vain, unbearable to watch. The body and the endless rearrangements it undergoes to rise again. There's no doubt I'd gone under. Throughout my long season of grief, life came and went on this pond. Wrong to say the heron decides. The light shifts. So too the pressure on the hollow bones of birds, widows. My great blue came and went. And for my final poem, Last Wishes. And again, my thanks, Henry, Amanda, and each of you. Last Wishes. This poem begins on my pond that the town owns. I go to Ireland on the west coast in Dingle, and I end up in Newfoundland. Last Wishes. When I go to leave this world, how do I take with me the grace it held out, it held on to? When I go, that momentary grace I caught now and again as I'd look up, look out. Once, late afternoon, a March wind swaying the elm, the shadows Matisse's blue cutouts, thighs thick as limbs dancing over the rumpled snow on such delicate, pointed feet. Once, columns of snow swirling across my pond, and I saw stampeding horses, saw again those sheep outside Dingle, a dog driving them left, then right, lower, to upper field. When I go, that streaming once more mine. Or when I go, the sudden rising of hundreds of swallows banking as one, then banking again. The nearly closed arc of an Arctic tern's wing turning in flight. When to the next wherever I'm going, mound, mountain, lap of God, let my leaving be its own imprint of grace. The eagle I once saw drift down over a river, extend its talons, graze the water and lift. The imprint of that long, slow swoop, what's first and last remembered when I go, then, only then, the shock of it, prize fish taken out of its world. Thank you. And now I get to turn the mic over to my good friend, Mary Pinard. You've already found out that Mary and I work together on our poems. We share our poems. Mary has been such a significant person in my life. Mary teaches at Babson. Mary is a gifted teacher, and I'm the lucky beneficiary of having had such a wonderful poet friend companion show me things about my work that I didn't know was there. Missed opportunities in my work, places to take greater advantage. So it's my pleasure to introduce Mary to you. She'll read from her new collection, Portal.
Thank you.
I can stand. Then okay. You don't have to move it. Yeah. Right. Is that good?
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks. Great. Okay. Henry, Amanda, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming out. It feels a little cooler.
Yes.
That's the impact of Maura. She cools everything down, brings everybody together. I'm very happy to be here. I'm going to be reading from my collection, Portal. The name Portal has a couple of different references. One is to the literal porthole of a tugboat, and also the ways in which portals or holes or are like passages moving from one place to another. So I'm playing around with that title. The book began with a family story, and it grew beyond that when I was trying to understand the nature of the family story. And the family story is this. My brother, who at the time was in his 50s, left a dead-end job and took a job as a cook on a tugboat because that was his life plan and wish to work on the water. I feel happy and at home to be in Gloucester. Alas, before a year was out, he drowned in that tugboat when it was pulled over by the barge it was towing. And so say again?
Within a year?
Yeah, it was under a year. So he was just, and his wish was, he started as a cook, and he was going to sort of do it until he could become more than a cook and eventually spend his life on the water. So in trying to understand what had happened, I understood much, much more about the nature of what it means to be on the water. Also, what I understood is that there were environmental issues involved in why that accident happened, not to mention pilot error. So the book is both a family story and exploration, but also a wish to understand the nature of the environment and how we need to take care of it so it doesn't come back and cause things like what happened to my brother. So I'd like to read a few poems that I hope will give you a sense of him, and then a few poems about the nature of the estuary, which is where his tugboat sank. I learned a lot about estuaries in trying to understand this story. This poem is one of several that appears in a poem called On Jacob's Ladders. Jacob's Ladder, as you know, has a scriptural reference, but it also is a real-life kind of ladder that appears on ships. It's one of those movable, swaying ladders that pilots often use to scramble up from a smaller boat to a bigger boat. And so I'm interested in this idea of ladders and how they connect and disconnect. And this poem is about my brother as a maker of ladders. He created a high dive. So I like this idea of him sailing off the high dive and then, of course, thinking about what happened to him later in his life. High dive. More flying than diving, everything about him preparing for the graceful lift out, as if my brother were the curve itself in motion, that arc I can still see expanding into a bird shadow over the glassy lake, then disappearing through the rippling. I still don't know where he got the know-how to build the high dive, that soaring wooden tower at the end of our summer dock, lacy with crisscrossing beams, railings, a ladder leaned up to the platform. I remember him climbing, more gliding, really, as if there were no rungs, just pale lines floating between pockets of air, up and up there, where he gripped the edge with his toes, a balance held, it seemed, by every fiber, muscle tensed. How did he know the dimensions, cut of wood, and whether in the end it would all hold anyone, support a body, its weight? How much I've thought of this, held close the image of him in flight between platform and water, alongside what I can imagine of his drowning years later, his last moments trapped in the galley of a sinking tugboat. All that weight settling. I wanted him to know how to save himself, and maybe he tried, since they found his body floating not in the flooded galley where he was last seen, alive, but on a higher deck, on another level, entirely. Only a narrow, steep ladder leaned between. So part of this poem, too, was my convincing a tugboat company to let me spend a day with them on a tugboat so I could get a sense of, well, what the heck is this boat, and what does it mean to be working this giant engine, really? That's what a tugboat is. So this is the third section of this little poem called Jacob's Ladder, and it's called Pilot, and it's about me watching this amazing pilot on this tugboat. The nimble docking pilot scrambles up the Jacob's Ladder, suspended from the gas tanker's white gunnels, 150 feet above.
Worn wood slat rungs shimmy in wind, the sea spume splashing his back, a buffeting as he scrambles up, up, and nonetheless up. I try to keep him in my sights from where I stand on the wide deck of the tug he's just left behind. I'm a visitor here on a pass to learn propulsion, something about tug capacity, design. What bridge across loss? He, too, appears to disappear high into salt mist. But he'll soon meet the carrier's overseas crew, assume their controls, and radio in hand, pilot all of us safely to the home port. I'm thinking again about the sea and boats, and I want to read this poem to you called Diesel. It's a little sonnet about my brother's love of the smell of diesel. He was a cool guy, had some interesting loves, including the smell of diesel. And I want to mention to you a reference I'm sure you'll know, which is to this wonderful film called High Noon. Gary Cooper was the star. It was, I think it came out in the 50s, and there was a wonderful theme song that went along with that film, which I'll try to sing, the couplet of the poem. Diesel. I never asked you what it meant, your love for the smell of diesel. Tincture of steel and propulsion, its bituminous mood, a bluish trace of alchemy. You sniffed those air-warping fumes in car lots, in unlimited hydroplane pits, boat slips in Seattle. I watched you change lanes, speed the freeway if it meant getting downwind of distillate exhausts. So much you loved blurred past, blurring quick to something else, the cheap buzz from Swisher Sweet Cigarellos, everything after our mother died, that hero dream you got from Coop in High Noon. Do not forsake me, oh my darling, beating our unbearable ache. My brother, as I realized later, and was sort of, I was in his house after he died and kind of looking at his things in ways that you never look at things until after a person is gone. And suddenly I realized, well, of course he knew how to build a high dive. He was a woodworker. And this poem is called Blue Lathe, and it's a kind of a love poem to his lathe, which he left behind. Blue Lathe. His lathe is still blue, I'm thinking, still there on his workbench. I like to look at it in snapshots I took the day I stole into his empty house. Calls made, everyone was out, tending details. Wanting, as I was, to mark what I knew he had already finished, or was cradling in the lathe. For his hand-turned lamps, he'd preferred to work a black walnut tree, storm-downed on our great-aunt Alice's Minnesota farm. She'd saved it until my brothers could haul its remains back west. He liked knowing these same thick arms held the rope swing he'd swung on with them through all those summers they visited there. I was too small then to go, but in some pictures I took, I can see how my lamp, his last gift to me, might have come to be. There, alongside the lathe, he'd left a silver-gray branch, shorn of leaves, sawed even at either end, ready to be held horizontal, pierced into place by metal pins, and ready for the cutting tool, a fine blade to be laid freehand on the bark. More pressure here, less, and it's peeled and grooved at the same time. What had been held in the lathe, no doubt his next lamp, stands, still upright, and to the right, mostly unstained, though this is a lighter wood, and it's clear he was trying different dyes, maple at the middle, a darker hue near the top, and in these patches of pattern of honey-colored waves moves in unison. The one visible burl opens near the bottom, eye-like, gazing out of the grain. And at the base, faint two stains, fingerprints, blurred, quick on the unfinished wood, as if he knew he would be back later. I wanted to read a couple of poems from a long poem called Song Net for an Estuary, which is a sonnet redoublé, and I know we have poets in the room, and a sonnet redoublé is kind of an insanity-making form where all the lines of the first sonnet reappear in the subsequent 14 sonnets, each subsequently the last line. So what happens is it's like you start with this condensed golf ball of lines, and then you spring them open across the poem and open 14 additional poems. But of course, they're all connected. So this was a poem where I was trying to come to terms with, well, what does it mean for a tugboat to go down in an estuary? And I wanted to just give you a feel for growing up in the Pacific Northwest, which is sort of, it's Gloucester-like, but it's specific to there. So just a couple poems from here. This is the second poem in the songnet for an estuary. I grew up near an estuary north of here, nearer Puget Sound, where land and water are reeled together, gravity-bound, first for containment, two worlds held close, edge of fire or flood, then for splicing, that lapping, like words made, little waves on the tongue. When anyone asks what a sound is, whether it's a long channel, that watery stretch between two larger bodies, or the air bladder of a fish, or the making of longing into words, voice, I say yes, these all are its buoys of meaning, to mark, fetter what we might forsake from a worn dock on this rainy tidal inlet. I can make out the fairway buoy tipping, half red, half white in the channel current. Navigational, it signals a shipping lane or nearby landfall. That it's anchored somehow in the baffling ocean bottom, that eternal flux is supposed to show the water surrounding to be free of hazards. Since 1500, though Spaniards, then maybe Drake, Russians from Alaska, namesake Gray, knows their laden sloops nearby, thinking it was new, a basin, teeming with beaver, otter, gold in the ears of the Chehalis, first people here, who must have wondered at the trade-offs, a salmon for a nail, a river for a blanket, a skin for a rain-soaked city. I wonder what this cosmopolis would be without its estuary. And just going to read two more poems. I wanted to read a poem about Maura mentioned getting herself to Ireland to research the beautiful books, illuminated manuscripts. So I go to Peoria, Illinois to research the sound of tugboats on the river. So, because I really wanted to know that. So this sonnet, which is part of that longer series, tries to get at that. And to understand my brother's wish to work on a tug. To qualify for deck work on a tug, you have to be able to lift 100 pounds, pass a simulator class, radar training, a physical exam. You have to be as capable of coiling 3-inch steel chain or nylon hawser as you are at marking time, 6 hours on, 6 hours off. And then there's the closeness to the edge, ever shifting, fen or pier, salt marsh or dock. And while the sea rhythms of tide and gull swirl play here, deckhands endure drums, the constant clatterdum, clatterdum of internal combustion, fuel pistoned through cylinders, plugs that spark spasms, mechanical. Whoosh, huff, huffa, whoosh, huff, huffa, whoosh, huff, huffa, whoosh, huff, huff, whoosh, huff, huff, whoosh. Diesel engines gurr, batter, dark hearts sunk in the rib bony thrall of access for our land use. And I'm going to end with a little sonnet that celebrates the estuary, which I have grown to love because it's easy to exploit it. And it's one of the things that happened to the estuary where my brother's boat went down. They had scoured the bottom of the harbor to increase the ability for tugboats to pass back and through. So it complicated the currents and therefore contributed to the accident that drowned my brother. So estuaries, in my estimation, are kind of way up there and need to be celebrated. This is a little sonnet. Estuary. The estuary is slide and suspension, a prism of rhythms. It has a tidal chorus, high crested in a freshet, hushed at the ebb, like in a Greek play. Impossible to limb, almost, says an artist I know, It's made of remnant floods and inflow, flux, plus mudflat habitat and beds of silt, whose sheets go twisted, shorn, remade. Epibenthic green algae like it there, or, depending, starry flounders, anchovies, even the long-fin smelt. A form of expansion, like an epic for a poet. The Hudson's is 300 quixotic miles, or a fleet deep eddy Dickinson might have turned. Sweetgrass, sedge, weave a marsh around it, as kestrel, curlew, vagrant shrew carry its evanescent root to light. No two ever alike, ephemeral as phosphorescence at night. Thank you very much. Thank you.